Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 25, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Shelby County v. Holder. The question in the case was whether Congress's 2006 decision to reauthorize Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act under the pre-existing coverage formula of Section 4B of the Voting Rights Act exceeded its authority under the 14th and 15th Amendments and thus violated the 10th Amendment in Article 4 of the United States Constitution. In an opinion delivered by Chief Justice Roberts, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional and therefore cannot be used to subject jurisdictions to preclearance requirements. Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito joined the majority opinion. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion. Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. To discuss the case, we have Abigail Bernstrom, who is the Vice Chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and an adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Bernstrom.
When we think of the great civil rights statutes of the mid-1960s, people first think of the Civil Rights Act of 64, and they think that was the biggie. But in fact, the most important of those two statutes was the Voting Rights Act, passed a year later in 1965. It was passed after Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama, where peaceful marchers heading to the Edmund Pettus Bridge were assaulted by police with billy clubs. John Lewis, now a congressman, got his head bashed in. And it was a bloody Sunday. And after that day, Lyndon Johnson said, we need a Voting Rights Act. And by August of that year, we had a voting rights statute, which was very badly needed. I mean, people think of the Voting Rights Act today, they think, oh, all these gerrymandered districts and this very heavy hand of the Justice Department taking power away from states and localities to structure their own elections. But in 1965, less than half of black voters in the Deep South were registered to vote. And in Mississippi, it was about 7%. It's actually a little under 7%. Of eligible black citizens were registered to vote, could cast a ballot in elections. And they were kept from the polls by violence, intimidation, and fraudulent literacy, mostly fraudulent literacy tests. And the intimidation, you know, would take the form of employers being notified that so-and-so, Mr. So-and-so, but of course in the Deep South, blacks did not have the word Mr. or Mrs. before them. In fact, they often didn't have a last name. It was just Jim is trying to register to vote. And that would put their economic livelihood in jeopardy. In Selma itself, in 65, only 1% of eligible blacks were registered. But that violent resistance of the white South to peaceful marching on the part of civil rights activists, that violent resistance, which was on television screens across the nation, that spelled the defeat of the Jim Crow South. It is really the turning point historically in Southern black subjugation. And so it was not only a necessary act, it was also, and conservatives should never forget how essential it was. Sometimes political power is important, and in the case of the Voting Rights Act, it was important. It was the original act was beautiful legislation. It was designed to hit precisely those jurisdictions that were disfranchising blacks. Today, the trigger for coverage, the trigger that determines which jurisdictions are covered by the extraordinary provisions of the Voting Rights Act, and the extraordinary provisions were the trigger itself, Section 4, which was just struck down, and Section 5, the preclearance provision. They were, as I said, beautifully designed to hit just the right jurisdictions. The Justice Department already knew which states were disfranchising blacks. They had been litigating this issue for a long time, and every time they won a case, the local authorities would find a way around the judgment in the case. And so it was no use continuing to just litigate voting rights and trying to put ballots in black hands by doing so. Again, legislation was needed. And the Voting Rights Act, I mean, very quickly did its job. In contrast to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and in contrast, for instance, to, this is not legislation, but a Supreme Court decision, in contrast to Brown versus Board, which, you know, 12 years after Brown versus Board, most schools in the Deep South were still segregated. And the 64 Act, which went after employment discrimination and so forth, that took a long time to really kick in. But the Voting Rights Act had an immediate impact. There really was no way around it. Again, a testimony to how well it was designed. But in addition, I think the black residents, the white residents of the South understood 15th Amendment rights, which was what the Voting Rights Act was all about. 15th Amendment rights are kind of fundamental to the integrity of this country. And so there really wasn't any kind of serious, principled argument for maintaining the old regime. Now, the original act was quickly changed. It morphed as a consequence of congressional amendments, judicial decisions, and practices of the Justice Department in enforcing the act. In effect, the statute was amended to ensure the political equality that it had implicitly promised. Now, blacks came to be treated, and this was not the original vision, blacks came to be treated as politically different, as entitled to inequality in the form of a unique political privilege. That unique political privilege was protection, black protection from whites, the protection of black candidates from the competition of white candidates. The Justice Department and courts and Congress were insisting that as a remedy for electoral discrimination, jurisdictions draw race-based districts, race-conscious districts, create safe black seats, and later down the road after 1975, safe Hispanic seats, to ensure minority office holding. Those of you who have been following affirmative action for years, as I suspect most people on this call have, know that the heart of all affirmative action policies, protecting blacks from white competition, that is, affirmative action in university admissions, for instance, are protecting black applicants from white competition and Asian competition. Asians aren't very much part of the Voting Rights Act, although they are a protected group. But they aren't clustered residentially enough so that gerrymandered districts can be drawn to make sure that Asians have legislative seats. But in any case, the Voting Rights Act, in that sense, is an affirmative action act, protecting blacks from white competition. Now, the power of federal authorities to force jurisdictions to adopt what the Justice Department and courts and Congress as well, to adopt what they called racially fair districting maps. That power was deeply at odds with the commitment to federalism that is obviously embedded in the Constitution, and the entitlement that courts and the Justice Department created to save black seats was equally at odds with traditional American assumptions about representation in a democratic society. But again, in 1965, a century of 15th Amendment violations demanded what I have called federal wartime powers. And as on other occasions, when wartime powers were invoked, the consequence was a serious distortion of our constitutional order, but it was needed. It was essential. So I think Roberts made a very good decision in deciding to go after Section 4, not after Section 5. Had he gone after Section 5, tried to write an opinion that declared that provision unconstitutional, he would have been deep into the weeds of arguing about racial gerrymandering, particularly, arguing about the whole way that the Justice Department has enforced Section 5. There was no way he was going to win that argument. I mean, the left is just wedded to Section 5, which is now gone. And the only way in which he was going to, and there would have been, had he simply said Section 5 is unconstitutional, the preclearance provision is unconstitutional, if he had said that, there would have been a firestorm across the nation, all headlines in every mainstream newspaper saying court kills Voting Rights Act. He avoided that by simply saying, we're going to basically talk about Section 5. I'm going to talk about the trigger mechanism that determines Section 5 coverage. And it was a much safer course. It was a much more effective course because you didn't have this firestorm. And indeed, it wasn't necessary to go after Section 5. If you go after the trigger mechanism determining coverage and say that's dead, well, then the coverage is dead. I mean, there are no more covered jurisdictions covered by the preclearance provision. So it doesn't matter whether they declared Section 5 unconstitutional.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.